Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, May the 8th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the release of a new book highlighting the contributions of Zimbabwe Liberation Movement co-founder Herbert Shatipo. In North Africa, Algerians have commemorated the 76th anniversary of the French massacre of demonstrators, marking the beginning of the struggle for national independence. The Pentagon Africa Command, AFRICOM, a general, has expressed concern over the growing influence of the People's Republic of China on the African continent. And militia groups temporarily took over the headquarters of the newly installed United Nations interim government in the North African state of Libya. In the second and third hours, we listen to a briefing from the World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who will be discussing, along with his colleagues, the COVID-19 pandemic, the status of the spread of the virus, and the vaccination programs aimed at curtailing the pandemic. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week. Thank you.
Jamuna, as an Abin Kanyan, and Kayo to Mulugan in your Yama. Miss Mutun, that is the one. I can have a matu to the Ramana to Mulukana Bolo. Ah, Savani, Sori jaladi, tongan jaladi po akan jala, jala kabonde jala jala mangkuna jaladi. Mansa bong kere mansa bong, dole sato dole baloto anoro, kamadu ho. Thank you. dunya dunya munne na zuri madra ya zuri manza kiri nyama na dunya ba alakano alana ye alakano alana la kelala Be
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and that was the music of Guinea Conakry from the artist Sori Kandia Koyote, and that was an album, a two-volume album entitled La Voix de la Revolution, The Voice of the Revolution. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. Our lead story deals with the situation in the southern African state of Zimbabwe. And President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Friday implored the country to teach the younger generation about the country's liberation war history to enable them to appreciate and value its significance. The president said this while officiating at the joint launch of the exhibitions Zimbabwe at 41 and the biography of the late former Zimbabwe African National Union chairman, Comrade Herbert Shatipo, at the National Art Gallery. The biography is titled Herbert W. Shatipo, The Life and Legacy of Zimbabwe's First Black Advocate and Patriotic Freedom Fighter. The book was written by Elias Chipanze Machimedze. The launch was part of Zimbabwe's 41st Independence Day celebrations. This book brings to the fore our national liberation war heritage and memory, which as a nation, we should always tell our children and generations to come, the president said. This will not only mold our children, but also make them appreciate and value our liberation war history. This is therefore a critical process that will consciously help our youth to forge into the future, yet at the same time remain grounded on who we are as Zimbabweans. President Mnangagwa said the late national hero brought an awakening on what it meant to be an African, and as the first African to direct executions in Tanganyika, now Tanzania, was instrumental in the establishment of law towards black emancipation. He said this helped in strengthening solidarity among liberation movements. Comrade Shatipo's death, which was a sad moment that slowed the momentum of the liberation struggle, became a unifying and rallying point for comrades and nationalists, he said. The president said Zimbabwe should get inspiration in fighting imperial and neocolonial machinations. As we celebrate today, there is still a body of work that needs to be researched, collected and be told through literal and audiovisual work. I encourage the academia and youth to take up this challenge and fill the gap as we seek to collectively build a broader catalog of literature for the African Liberation War History Museum, said President Mnangagwa. On the exhibition, the president applauded the creative and cultural sector for capturing and detailing the various facets of the country's history, culture, and heritage. The artistic depiction of aspects of our protracted liberation struggle, the peace, the unity, and development that came out of it, and indeed moving and fascinating, the president said. He said the sacrifices made by the liberation war fighters brought independence and freedom and equal opportunities. The Second Republic, he said, was committed to protecting the freedom and ensuring the growth of the creative industry. President Mnangagwa added that it was through the arts industry that Zimbabwe could tell its story from its own and African perspective. Looking ahead, I challenge the creative cultural industries to be the theater for harnessing the country's potential towards the achievement of key national priorities and aspirations as outlined in National Development Strategy 1 and Vision 2030, said President Mnangagwa. He implored the arts sector to promote peace and unity through their work and not be used as a tool to denigrate the nation's and its aspirations. The president pledged government support for the National Arts Gallery of Zimbabwe's participation at the Venice Biennial 2022 to be held in Venice, Italy. The 59th Venice Biennial International Contemporary Art Exhibit will be held between April and November of 2022. Author of Comrade Shatipo's biography, Mr. Machimedze, said he was inspired to write the book by the contributions of the late national hero of the country's independence. He urged young people to take a keen interest in Zimbabwe's history. In the North African state of Algeria, earlier today, thousands honored those killed by French forces in 1945 as the North African country waits for Paris to apologize for its colonial era crimes. Pro-independence protests broke out after a rally on May 8th of 1945, marking the Allied victory over Nazi Germany. The rebellion triggered 2 weeks of bloody repression in which French troops massacred thousands of mostly unarmed Muslim civilians, a key chapter in Algeria's long independence struggle. Earlier today, thousands of people took part in a march of remembrance following the same route through the northeastern city of Sétif as the May 8th rally 76 years ago, official media reported. Led by scouts, participants laid a wreath at the monument of the Bouzid Sow, a 22-year-old man shot dead by a French policeman in 1945 for refusing to lower his Algerian flag, the first casualty of the violence. The crackdown led by French-German Raymond Duval left as many as 45,000 dead, according to Algerian official figures. French historians put the toll at up to 20,000, including 86 European civilians and 16 soldiers killed in revenge attacks. The killings had a transformative impact on the nascent anti-colonial movement, setting the scene for a full-blown independence war 9 years later that finally led to independence in 1962. Algerian officials have continued to call for a full apology from France for its colonial-era policy, and President Abdelmadjid Tebboune has described the 1945 killings as, quote, crimes against humanity, unquote. Government spokesman Amar Bilhemer repeated that the demand on Saturday, calling for the official, definitive, and comprehensive recognition by France of its crimes, along with repentance and fair compensation. He also called for help dealing with the toxic waste left behind by 17 nuclear tests France carried out in the Algerian desert in the 1960s. The summer of 1945 saw French forces carry out a 15-day campaign of violence around Sétif, 300 kilometers, 190 miles east of Algiers, the capital. French authorities, which had occupied and colonized the North African country since 1830, imposed martial law and indiscriminately massacred women, children, and the elderly. Nationalist leaders were detained on pure suspicion, and villages suspected of harboring separatists were strafed by the Air Force and set ablaze. Some 44 villages were destroyed by the French. Executions continued until November of 1945, and some 4,000 people were arrested. Cured you peace for 10 years, General Duval warned the colonial government in a letter. If France does nothing, it will all happen again. Only next time will be worse and may well be irreparable. Sétif remains a highly sensitive episode for Algerians as well as for some in France. Paris only officially recognized the killings in 2005 when the French ambassador in Algiers called the massacres, quote, an inexcusable tragedy, unquote. France has since made moves to recognize other crimes committed during its 132-year occupation of Algeria. In March, President Emmanuel Macron admitted, quote, in the name of France, unquote, that lawyer and independence figure Ali Boumediene had been detained, tortured, and killed by French forces, who then covered up his death as a suicide. Last year, Macron tasked French historian Benjamin Stora to assess how France has dealt with its colonial legacy and urged officials to accelerate the opening of French archives on the Algerian War. Released in January, the Stora report made several recommendations, including the creation of a, quote, memory and truth commission, unquote, to hear testimony from those who suffered during the war. It did not, however, suggest a formal state apology. Macron has offered neither, quote, repentance nor apologies, unquote, but rather, quote, symbolic acts, unquote, of reconciliation. Algeria did, however, welcome Macron's admission of French responsibility for the Boumediene's death. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. a worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. In other news, the top United States General for Africa is warning that a growing threat from China may come not just from the waters of the Pacific, but from the Atlantic as well. U.S. General Stephen Townsend, in an interview with the Associated Press, said Beijing is looking to establish a large Navy port capable of hosting submarines or aircraft carriers on Africa's western coast. Townsend said China has approached countries stretching from Mauritania to south of Namibia, intent on establishing a naval facility. If realized, that prospect would enable China to base warships and its expanding navy in the Atlantic, as well as the Pacific Oceans. They're looking for a place where they can rearm and repair warships. That becomes military useful in conflict, said Townsend, who heads the United States Africa Command. He went on to say that they're a long way towards establishing that in Djibouti. Now they're casting their gaze to the Atlantic coast and wanting to get such a base there. Townsend's warnings comes as the Pentagon shifts its focus from the counterterrorism wars of the last two decades to the Indo-Pacific region and threats from greater power adversaries such as China and the Russian Federation. The Biden administration views China's rapidly expanding economic influence as military might as America's primary long-term security challenge. United States military commanders around the globe, including the several who may lose troops and resources to bolster growth in the Pacific, caution that China's growing assertiveness isn't simply happening in Asia. And they argue that Beijing is aggressively asserting economic influence over countries in Africa, South America, and the Middle East, and is pursuing bases and footholds there. The Chinese are outmaneuvering, says the imperialist general, the U.S. and select countries in Africa. Port projects, economic endeavors, infrastructure, and their agreements and contacts will lead to greater access in the future. They are hedging their bets and making big bets on Africa, said the AFRICOM general. China's first overseas naval base was built years ago in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa, and it is steadily increasing its capacity. Townsend said as many as 2,000 military personnel are at the base, including hundreds of Marines who handle security there. They have arms, ammunition for sure. They have armored combat vehicles. We think they will soon be basing helicopters there to potentially include attack helicopters, according to General Townsend. For some time, many have thought that China was working to establish a Navy base in Tanzania, a country on the Africa's eastern coast that has had a strong, long-standing military relationship with Beijing. But Townsend said it appears there's been no decision on that yet. He said that while China has been trying hard to get a base in Tanzania, it's not the location he's most concerned about. He said that it's on the Indian Ocean side. I want it to be in Tanzania instead of on the Atlantic coast. The Atlantic coast concerns me greatly, pointing to the relatively shorter distance from Africa's west coast to the United States. In nautical miles, a base on Africa's northern Atlantic coast could be substantially closer to the U.S. than military facilities in China are to the American western coast. More specifically, other U.S. officials say that the Chinese have been eyeing locations for a port in the Gulf of Guinea. The Pentagon's 2020 report on China's military power says China has likely considered adding military facilities to support its naval, air, and ground forces in Angola, among other locations, and it noted that the large amount of oil and liquefied natural gas imported from Africa and the Middle East make those regions high priority for China over the next 15 years. Henry Tugendhat, a senior policy analyst with the United States Institute of Peace, said China has a lot of economic interests on Africa's west, including fishing and oil. China also has helped finance and build a large commercial port in Cameroon. He said that any effort by Beijing to get a naval port on the Atlantic coast would be an expansion of China's military presence. But the desire for ocean access, he said, may be primarily for economic gain rather than military capabilities. Townsend and other regional commanders laid out their concerns about China during recent congressional hearings. He, along with Admiral Craig Fowler and head of the U.S. Southern Command, General Frank McKenzie, head of the U.S. Central Command, are battling to retain their military forces, aircraft, and surveillance assets as the Pentagon continues to review the shift to greater power competition. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is conducting a global posture review to determine if America's military might is positioned where it needs to be and in the right numbers around the world to best maintain global dominance. That review is expected to be finished by the end of the summer. And finally, in a show of force, armed militiamen briefly took over a hotel in the Libyan capital of Tripoli that serves as a headquarters for the interim government. That's according to officials in Tripoli earlier today. Friday's development came after the three-member presidential council earlier this week appointed a new chief of the intelligence agency, Libya's version of the CIA. The militias, which control Tripoli, were apparently unhappy with the choice of Hussein Khalifa as the new spy chief. Presidential Council spokeswoman Najwa Weber said no one was hurt in the takeover of Hotel Corinthia in the heart of Tripoli. The hotel was mostly empty on Friday, which is the beginning of the Muslim weekend. After a while, the militias left the hotel, according to an official at the Interior Ministry who spoke on condition of anonymity under regulations. Khalifa and the militia leaders were not immediately available for comment earlier today. Takeover underscored the tough road ahead for the interim government, which has been tasked with steering Libya through general elections that are due by the end of the year. The government has struggled to unite the conflict-stricken nation ahead of the vote. Weber said the presidential council has no permanent headquarters and that the hotel is one of the places where the council convenes. Videos circulating on social media show militiamen at the entrance of the hotel. On Monday, Najla El Mankouch, the foreign minister of Libya's interim government, called for the departure of all foreign forces and mercenaries, including Turkish troops, from the oil-rich North African country. This was seen as a rebuke to Turkey and angered pro-Turkey factions in western Libya. United Nations Security Council diplomats say there are more than 20,000 foreign fighters and mercenaries in Libya, including Syrians, Sudanese, Chadians, and Russians. Libya has plunged into chaos when a NATO-backed uprising in 2011 toppled the longtime revolutionary Pan-Africanist leader, Muammar Gaddafi, who was later killed at the aegis of the United States. The oil-rich country has in recent years been split between the rival East and West-based administrations, each backed by different armed groups as well as foreign governments. With that, though, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, magazines, journals, in research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-Africa Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, May 8th, 2021, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. The programs can be shared with other potential listeners via email, blogs and websites, as well as social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and that was the music of Detroit's own Motown Sound, the Four Tops, with the tune entitled You Keep Running Away from 1967. And right now we want to move into the World Health Organization briefing from Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. And, of course, we present these briefings on a regular basis related to the COVID-19 pandemic as well. The vaccination programs that are being rolled out internationally, as well as other public health issues. So we're going to tune in to hear this broadcast, which was done yesterday in Geneva, Switzerland. And, of course, the World Health Organization has just been rejoined by the Biden administration, although the level of international cooperation between the current Biden administration and the World Health Organization.
Hello and good day to wherever you are listening to us today. It is Friday, 7 May 2021. My name is Christian Littmeier, and I'm welcoming you to today's global COVID-19 press conference with a focus on the new WHO Council on the Economics of Health Fall. For this, we have a very special guest today. I'm happy to welcome Professor Mariana Mazzucato, the chair of the WHO Council on the Economics for Health for All, and professor in the Economics of Innovation and Public Value at the University College in London, and founding director of the UCL. Welcome. We have also a very special situation today because many of you have been waiting for the outcome of the TAG EUL and the SAGE deliberations, so we have guests for this too. We have the chair of the TAG, Professor Arnaud Didier-Laurent, with us, and Professor Alejandro Cravioto, the chair of the SAGE, for any further discussions later. But first, of course, here in the room, we have Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General, Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director of WHO's Health Emergencies Program, Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, Technical Lead on COVID-19, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, Chief Scientist, Dr. Miangela Simaos, Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products, and Dr. Bruce Aylward, Special Advisor to the Director General and the Lead on the ACT Accelerator. Now, let me hand over to the Director General for the opening remarks. Dr. Tedros, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Wednesday's announcement by the United States of America that it will support a temporary waiver of intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines is a significant statement of solidarity and support for vaccine equity. I know that this is not a politically easy thing to do. So I very much appreciate the leadership of the United States, and we urge other countries to follow their example. I also want to emphasize that WHO values the incredible contribution of the private sector to the pandemic and to health in general. We would not have the vaccines, medicines, diagnostics, and devices that save lives and improve well-being around the world if it were not for the innovation of the private sector. WHO supports companies making a fair return on their investment in research and development for investment in further innovation. We are in an unprecedented crisis that requires unprecedented action. Cases are at a record high. Almost 100,000 people are dying globally each week. And we have a chronic vaccine crisis. The World Trade Organization provisions for IP waivers were designed precisely for a situation like this. If we don't use them now, then when? It's also important to remember that intellectual property waivers will need to be accompanied by transfer of technology and know-how for this difficult-to-make vaccines. We continue to encourage all member states to support technology transfer through CTAP, the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool. We encourage governments to offer incentives to manufacturers to share technology and know-how. And we encourage countries with the most vaccines to donate doses through COVAX, which is the fastest and most equitable way to increase the distribution of vaccines globally. Just as it takes a comprehensive approach of public health measures to defeat COVID-19, so solving the vaccine crisis requires that we pull out all the stops. WHO is continuing to explore every avenue for increasing access to vaccines globally. This afternoon, WHO gave emergency use listing to Sinopharm Beijing's COVID-19 vaccine, making it the sixth vaccine to receive WHO validation for safety, efficacy, and quality. This expands the list of vaccines that COVAX can buy and gives countries confidence to expedite their own regulatory approval and to import and administer a vaccine. The Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, or SAGE, has also reviewed the available data and recommends the vaccine for adults 18 years and older with a two-dose schedule. Vaccines remain a vital tool. But right now, the volume and distribution of vaccines is insufficient to end the pandemic. Without the sustained and tailored application of public health measures that we know work. The COVID-19 pandemic is a vivid demonstration that health crisis is not just a health crisis. It can have dramatic consequences for livelihoods, businesses, and economies. The pandemic has shown that when health is at risk, everything is at risk. But when health is protected and promoted, individuals, families, communities, economies, and nations can thrive. That's why universal health coverage is WHO's top priority. All roads should lead to universal health coverage. I repeat, all roads should lead to universal health coverage. But globally, we're going in the wrong direction. Around the world, more households are spending an increasing proportion of their income on health, and more people are being exposed to poverty as a result of out-of-pocket health spending. It's clear that making progress toward this universal health coverage cannot just be a matter for ministries of health, but takes an all-of-government approach with leadership from the highest political levels and close engagement with ministries of finance. As we recover and rebuild, we have a unique moment to mobilize investments for healthier, more resilient, more productive, and more sustainable societies. We need a new narrative that makes health for all the central goal of public policies on innovation, industry, employment, environment, and more. That's why we have established a new WHO Council on the Economics of Health for All to identify new ways to shape the global economy and to build societies that are healthy, inclusive, equitable, and sustainable. The Council comprises 11 distinguished experts in economics, health, government, finance and development from around the world, and is chaired by Professor Mariana Mazzucato, the Professor of the Economics of Innovation and Public Value and Founding Director of the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose at University College London. Professor Mazzucato, thank you for your leadership of this new council. And thank you for joining us today. And you have the floor.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros. I cannot tell you what an honor it's been also talking to you in the last months about this council. And it was so wonderful yesterday when we met for the first time with the 11 women. And as you and I have said, when people ask us why only women, we will say why not. So I'm already preempting one of the questions. The mission of the Council is to provide a new approach to shape the economy with the objective of building healthy societies that are just, inclusive, equitable, and sustainable. And fundamentally, what we want to do is reverse the usual logic. So what's the usual logic? The usual logic says invest in health because it's good for the economy. And we also find relationships between health and economic growth. We want to be much more bold and provocative than that. We want to say, focus on the goal. The goal is health for all. And for all the reasons that Dr. Tedros just explained, why that's crucial. And then we backtrack and understand how to restructure the economy. What does that mean? New financing tools, new types of public-private relationships. The private sector, of course, is important. So crowding in the private sector in fundamental areas that are critical for health for all. New ways to think about the debt and the deficit, so we're not always, you know, asking very siloed questions, but also new ways to structure our budgets. So outcomes-based budgeting, outcomes being health for all. So we really want to unpick the economy or economic structures in order to deliver on that goal. And to do that, I think the really important point that Dr. Tedros mentioned is the narrative. You know, where does innovation come from? Where do healthy societies come from? To do that, we really need to unpick the notions of value and of wealth and innovation, which again have often been very siloed. There's going to be four major areas of work, and maybe I'll just touch on them very quickly. One is on measurement. You know, how do we actually value and measure health for all? And that means both within organizations, but also, of course, with GDP metrics, which we all know are limited. But unfortunately, we have not succeeded in really replacing the kind of, you know, static notions of, say, cost-benefit analysis and net present value as, again, kind of static ways to actually measure the value that, for example, ambitious policies can deliver. We want to focus on capacity on the ground, which we've, of course, with COVID-19 seen has really been missing in so many different countries. So what is the capacity within the public sector that's required in order also to collaborate with the private sector on all sorts of different areas? And unfortunately, as we have been under-financing, under-resourcing, but also under-imagining the role that the public sector can play, we want to really focus a lot on that. Third, finance. So the actual investment that's required in health for all, and that has two sides, both the financing, literally new financing tools, including how to redesign particular institutions like development banks to really also focus on health for all, but also the kind of macroeconomic finance, again, coming back to these issues of deficits, debts, and outcomes-based budgeting. And finally, innovation, which is so central to, you know, the topic this week and last week around the big news from the Biden administration in terms of how do we actually govern innovation, including not only intellectual property rights, towards areas that we're sure will actually benefit people, right? So innovation for the common interest. And of course, we need to be incentivizing innovation and think of all sorts of issues that are critical for the private sector. But really, this is about nurturing collective intelligence. The private sector is very important, but so is the public sector in innovation. In the U.S., you know, where Biden is leading the country, the public sector puts $40 billion a year in health innovation. So they are also creating value, co-creating value. So how can we actually govern that collective creation of innovation in such a way that people actually benefit? So these are the four areas, and I think I've spoken enough, so I'm happy to pass back to Dr. Tedros and happy to also answer any questions later.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mariana. Thank you, Professor Mazzucato. And I very much look forward to the Council's work in the months and years ahead and look forward to working with you very closely. And thank you so much for your leadership.
Thank you.
Finally, Wednesday marked the International Day of the Midwife. To mark the day, WHO, the UN Population Fund, the International Confederation of Midwives, and other partners published the 2021 State of the World's Midwifery Report, which shows that the world currently faces a shortage of 900,000 midwives. Fully investing in midwives by 2035 would avert roughly two-thirds of maternal and newborn deaths and stillbirths, saving 4.3 million lives per year. Midwives are not a cost. They're an investment in a healthier, safer, fairer future for all of us. Christian, back to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tedros. With this, we're opening the floor for questions. And again, let me remind you that we have, as other special guests, also Professor Arnaud Didier-Laurent, from the chair of the Technical Advisory Group, and Professor Alejandro Gavioto, the chair of the SAGE. And in order to get into the queue, please raise your hand. And we'll start with Emma Farge from Reuters. Emma, please unmute yourself.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. I was wondering, 2 months away from the Olympics, is there any safe way for it to happen? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll start with Dr. Van Kerkhove.
Yeah, I'll start, and others may want to come in. You know, the question of sort of, you asked a very specific question. I'm going to give you a very vague answer. There are a lot of things that are happening right now globally where we're seeing an increase in cases around the world. We have reached the highest level of case incidence. The number of deaths that are being reported around the world is really shocking this late into a pandemic. When we have the tools at hand that can prevent infections, that can prevent those who are infected from spreading to others, and can prevent people from dying. One of the biggest ways in which we know can limit the spread is around our physical distancing and reducing the number of contacts that we have. Having said that, what we advise in every situation is taking a risk-based approach, because the situation globally is very different. The intensity of transmission is very different. And so at an individual level, we're asking everyone to know what your risk is through that activity and take measures to lower your risk. Practice your physical distancing, wearing a mask, avoid crowded spaces, make sure you have good ventilation if you're indoors. It's as simple as opening the windows if it's safe to do so. Practice respiratory etiquette. Get a vaccine when it's your turn. Avoid mass gatherings. And when there are events that are taking place, we support countries in using this risk-based approach to take the decision about if an event can happen. This is for the Olympics, as well as for having a barbecue in your home. Don't forget that even though there's a lot of attention for big gatherings like the Olympics, like religious festivals, like political rallies, there's also a risk at even some of these small gatherings at your home. It depends on where you live. It depends on how much virus is circulating. It depends on if there are appropriate measures that could be put in place to have a plan for case detection, for early recognition, for caring of those individuals, for contact tracing, a good communication plan. It also matters about the vaccine allocation and vaccine rollout in individual countries. So my answer is vague, because it matters for every single event, every single gathering that is happening worldwide right now. What we really need is everyone around the world to take measures to keep yourself safe, to minimize exposure to this virus and the virus variants, and make sure that you don't allow the virus to spread. Mike.
Thank you, Maria. Now, with specific reference, I think you were speaking specifically about the Olympics. The issues regarding the Olympics are multi-dimensional. There is the issue with regard to the safety of athletes and their teams within the environment of the Olympic Village and the Olympics themselves. Then there's the issue of the venues and whether spectators attend or don't attend. Then there's the issue of social mixing around those venues. And then there is the issue of whether spectators or attendees will come as from outside the country. And all of those have to be considered separately. It's not whether we will have an Olympics or not. It's how those individual risks within that framework are being managed. There's been a tremendous amount of work done on the playbooks for the teams and the delegations that are coming. A lot of preparation amongst those teams regarding testing and quarantines and arrival. And measures that have been taken in the Olympic villages, in the training facilities, and around the venues themselves. Then there is the matter of attendance within the facilities themselves, and I believe the Japanese authorities and the IOC still have not made final decisions regarding the level of attendance at those venues because of the variations in the incident situation in Japan itself. Positivity rates in Japan are around 7%. So Japan has experienced an increase over the last number of, like everybody else, over a period of weeks and months. That has leveled off. It is not continuing to increase. And it is our hope, and it is our hope for every country, that that continues on a downward trend. And we will leave it to the authorities in Japan, who are highly competent, to decide what level of attendance could occur in the Olympics. I think the authorities have already decided that spectators and others will not be allowed to come to the Olympics from abroad. So that's not something that's on the table at the moment. And then the issue will be the extent to which social mixing and socialising is allowed around the Olympic venues themselves. And again, I believe measures are being put in place for that, and decisions around that level of mixing will be made by the Japanese authorities in due course. And I've said the word mixing a number of times, and we've said this again and again with this virus. This virus transmits in places where people mix in higher density for prolonged periods of time. The aim of the protection around the athletes is to prevent that type of contact and mixing and close proximity, to create an environment of safety for the athletes, to create and maintain an environment of safety for everyone who attends, whatever that proportion is, and to create an environment of safety around the venues themselves. Some of those decisions cannot be made until closer to the event, because it will depend on the epidemiologic situation at that time. So it is not a failing at all on behalf of the organisers that they haven't made certain decisions, because those decisions can only be made on the basis of the epidemiologic parameters that pertain at that time. It is our hope that the Olympics can occur. Many other events, and we've seen sporting events and leagues run very, very safely over the last 6 months without spectators, with special bubbles and arrangements for athletes and for others, footballers and many, many others. It is a complex event. There are so many different events. There are so many different delegations. It is a test of logistics. It is a test of risk management. And we have confidence that the International Olympic Committee and the host city, Tokyo, and the government of Japan will make the right decisions regarding how best to manage the risks, and are working extremely hard right now to ensure that those risks are well managed. And we will leave any decisions regarding the extent to which the Olympics have attendance at venues and other decisions to them, as we believe they are applying a very, very systematic risk management approach to protect public health at this moment. And as needed, they will make the decisions that are needed based on the epidemiologic situation as we approach the July date.
Thank you very much, both, for this comprehensive view. And the next question goes to Donato Mancini from the Financial Times. Donato, please unmute yourself. Donato, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can. Can you?
Yes, no, it's okay.
Sorry about that. So thanks for taking my question. On Sinopharm, could you give us a bit more detail on data for older patients, on efficacy? Have you received reassurances from the company on what they will do to ensure that there is enough data, or that they will generate enough data for older patients? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Donato. I'll look at Professor Alejandro Cravioto, the chair of the SAGE. Professor?
Thank you very much. I hope you can hear me well.
Very well.
We have the working group that SAGE has to review COVID vaccines made a thorough assessment of all the information regarding the Sinopharm vaccine and came to the conclusion that there is enough evidence of safety and the capacity of the vaccine to prevent severe disease or symptomatic and hospitalized cases up to 79%. We have information that the vaccine is useful for people above 18 years of age. And as the person asking the question said, the information we have for people over 60 is still very scarce. There is no reason to think that the vaccine would behave differently in this older age group. And in fact, in many countries in the world where the vaccine is already being used, this group has already been vaccinated. So in that sense, what we're encouraging is for the company or the people who are now in charge of the country programs to make sure that they have strong follow-up programs of safety and effectiveness of the use of this vaccine, especially in three groups of people. The over 60-year-olds, for which we have little information, people with comorbidities, which are essential as one of the main components for mortality, and of course the issue of pregnancy, for which there is also very small, there's no information for this vaccine. Once we have this information, then as with any other vaccine that SAGE has reviewed, we will look at the new evidence and make changes in our interim recommendations for this vaccine. But for now, after getting an EUL approval, we see no reason why this vaccine should not be recommended fully for use of people 18 years and above in a dosage of two doses from 2 to 3 weeks apart. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Cravioto, and I'll look at Professor Arnaud Didier-Laurent, the chair of the TAC for safety, efficacy, and quality.
Thank you. So maybe I take the opportunity to explain a little bit what the TAC is doing. I think that's the first time we actually have the opportunity to do this. So actually we are a group of independent experts. I'm honored to chair. And we are from different countries, different expertise in the world. And our role is to perform a benefit risk assessment of COVID-19 candidate vaccines. And this is based on a report that is provided by the product evaluation team at WHO. So they're composed of regulatory experts of WHO, but also regulatory experts from different countries. So it is really a global effort, and we actually, in our assessment, we're particularly focusing on the specific needs of the low and middle income countries, including the way vaccines can be implemented. So in the context of these vaccines we're talking about, developed by the BIBP Sinopharm, we have reviewed data on quality of the vaccines, so that include outcome of an inspection of the manufacturing facilities. We also reviewed available data on efficacy and safety of the product, including the risk management plan, which is an important document because it includes the how we're going to monitor the performance of the vaccines after listing. So overall, and based on the robust assessment of this data and actually further clarification from the company, we concluded that the benefit risk assessment was favorable for this inactivated COVID-19 BIBP vaccine, and therefore we recommended actually this morning the listing of the vaccines for emergency use. To the question how this is going to be followed up, and actually like all the vaccines we have been listing as part of our group work, and the TAG and together with actually the WHO product evaluation group, we requested additional studies that include clinical and real-world evidence from the company that committed to perform these studies. So in fact, we're confident that we'll be able to generate data that the chairman of the SAGE mentioned in the future as soon as possible to actually allow a continuous evaluation of the vaccines because, in fact, the work doesn't stop after the listing because we continue reviewing data as they are provided by the manufacturers. And also I'd like to take the opportunity for, in behalf of the TAG members, first to thanks my colleagues in the TAG because we've been quite busy looking at this data, but also more importantly, the works from the WHO experts and regulatory experts for the decision today. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Professors Cravioto and Professor Didier Laurent. Next question goes to Agnes Pereiro from the AFP. Agnes, please unmute yourself.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Thank you for taking my question. My question concerns children. There are some pharma companies that are seeking now national approval for vaccinating children. And in this situation, do you recommend vaccination for children? And do you think that all the children should be vaccinated or only those who have certain medical conditions or comorbidities? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Agnes. And again, I will look at Professor Alejandro Cavioto, the chair of SAGE.
So far, we have no vaccines that have been authorized for use either through the EUA that the FDA or the EMA give, or through the EUL listing that the WHO receives. We know that there's a dossier that is being reviewed concerning the two mRNA vaccines in use, one by Pfizer and one by Moderna, to lower the age group from 16-year-olds to 12-year-olds, but this is still pending. For the time being, we don't think that there is the vaccine or the actual need to start thinking of this age group as a priority group within the framework that SAGE has designed to see who should be vaccinated and in which sequence. We feel that in the case of countries that have enough supply of vaccine to cover the global population that they have, this type of decisions would have to be made by the local regulatory authorities and the local technical advisory groups. In the case of countries that do not have an ample supply of vaccine, then we suggest that they continue to follow the SAGE framework map that lists how the vaccines should be used in different age groups, looking at how we decrease the mortality and the severity of disease, which are the main outcomes that we're looking for at this time. I do not know if Dr. O'Brien would like to add something to this comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Cavioto. Yes, indeed, we'll look at Dr. Kate O'Brien, Director of Immunization, Vaccines and Biologicals, to add on.
Yeah, let me just add a couple of things to that. We are aware that Canada did authorize the use of the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds on Wednesday, the first country to provide such an authorization. And we do expect additional authorizations to come through for younger age groups below the age of 16 years of age for which the Pfizer vaccine is already authorized. And we do expect those. We know that there are clinical trials that are ongoing for a number of products. And we expect from a regulatory perspective that there will be authorizations coming forward for those younger age groups. I do want to emphasize a couple of things. First of all, those authorizations do then provide a clearer pathway for children who have underlying medical conditions that put them at high risk of COVID outcomes. But I think the emphasis really needs to be on the prioritization of the highest priority age groups and those that are highest priority because of their exposures and because of their underlying medical conditions. And advancing to the use of vaccine, especially in younger children, and where the evidence about their role in transmission and certainly even younger children with even less transmission role, really before we've concluded the immunization of age groups and highest priority groups in every country around the world is laid out in the SAGE prioritization roadmap. And we would really like to reemphasize that the priority really needs to be getting vaccine to all countries in the world for the highest priority groups before we start advancing to groups that have a much lower risk of disease. And when we have supply that is adequately distributed in an equitable way so that every country has secured the implementation of vaccine for those highest priority groups, we very much welcome the use of vaccine, especially if it has a substantial impact on transmission.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien. Next question goes to Isabel Sacco from EFE. Isabel, please unmute yourself.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to know what is the most recent WHO assessment on the variants identified in India and that is responsible for the crisis that the country is living now. Do you know now if this this variant is responsible for the current situation? Do you think that it should be considered as a variant of concern? And I would like to know if you consider that this variant is a risk, or there is a risk to spread to countries that have managed the pandemic lately. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Isabel. And Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the question, and thank you for identifying this as the variant that was identified in India. This is the B.1.617, I believe, that you are referring to, which is indeed a virus variant, which is classified by WHO as a variant of interest at the global level. This is a variant that has several mutations that are of interest in terms of its ability to potentially cause increased transmissibility as well as reduced neutralization. We are, in fact, right now, the teams are meeting as we are here at this press conference to look at more detailed information from India as well as from other countries where this variant is also circulating. So part of your question was, is this variant being identified in other countries? And the answer is yes. Our ability to determine how much of this virus variant, the B.1.617, is circulating is largely dependent on the amount of genetic sequencing that is being done around the world. Now, that is increasing, and we're seeing much more and better and more targeted use of sequencing, but it is still spotty around the world. The variant of interest, this B.617, is one virus variant that is circulating in India. There is also the B.1.1.7, which is the virus variant that was identified first in the United Kingdom. This is classified as a variant of concern because it has demonstrated increased transmissibility, and this virus variant of concern has actually replaced other circulating strains in many countries around the world. So there's a combination of factors that are happening in India. We have the introduction of the B.1.1.7, which has demonstrated increased transmissibility. This B.1.617, which does have some characteristics that suggest increased transmissibility. I say suggests right now because we're trying to pull together all of the information we have so that we can make a proper assessment, and the teams are doing that right now. We will also be discussing the B.617 again with our virus evolution working group over the weekend. The other combination of factors associated with increased transmission in India has to do with social mixing and the number of contacts, the amount of mixing of individuals coming together, relaxation of some public health and social measures. It's a combination of factors. It isn't just one factor that is associated with increased transmission. The variants don't help. There are other virus variants that are circulating around the world that, of course, we're also looking at. So it's a combination of factors. But indeed, the 617 is one that we are looking at very, very carefully, looking at data that is coming directly from our colleagues in India who are studying this virus variant, as well as studies that are ongoing in other countries that have detected 617 in their populations. So we will have more information on that over the weekend and at the latest on Monday. But we summarize everything we know about the virus variants in our weekly epidemiologic record, including the 617. So what we published on Tuesday on our website, I wish I had it, I would also hold it up in front of me, but if you don't look at those weekly epidemiologic updates, there's a wealth of information that's in there. And every week, we will describe what we know about the three variants of concern, the B.1.1.7, the B.1.351, and the P.1, as well as seven variants of interest that we're tracking around the world. So it's a dynamic situation. The information is coming in fast and furious. We are working with scientists and partners around the world to consolidate our knowledge, the evidence that is coming online, even through preprints, and through reports coming from countries so that we can make a robust and a proper assessment about what we know, and then we can inform you accordingly.
And just maybe to add for emphasis there, that we're always concerned with variants because variants can have, they're different, they have a slightly different structure, so they can have slightly different properties. And those properties can affect transmission, they can affect their virulence or the way in which they cause disease or the severity of the disease that they cause. And that's why we're all concerned globally to track and monitor those variants. So first of all, that tracking and monitoring is in place, but it's patchy, and we don't have that monitoring in some places. And again, there's an equity issue in this as well. We don't have equitable distribution of the capabilities or the technologies to track these viruses at the genomic level. And we're working very, very hard within WHO and with our partners to do that. We're working very hard with our partners in the ACT Accelerator and the Diagnostics Pillar and others to try and shift that balance. The Wellcome Trust and many others are involved. Beyond that, and Maria is absolutely correct when she says that these viruses change over time, but what we've seen in South Africa with the B1351, without vaccine, South Africa brought that variant pretty much under control by applying public health and social measures, by building a partnership with communities, by decreasing mixing and crowding, by investing in diagnostics and testing, in identifying clusters and in bringing the disease under control. I'm not saying that you can stop the variants or even to stop completely the wild strain by just using those measures. My concern right now is that this virus has huge kinetic energy in some countries. It's got a massive force of infection, and we have got to slow that down because it has been driven by both human behavior, by the emergence of variants, and many other factors. In some senses, we're pushing three different accelerators at the same time. And we expect to slow down. We're expecting the virus to slow down, and we're pushing the accelerators. We have got to stop pushing the accelerators on this virus. We need to vaccinate more people and protect the vulnerable. We need to reduce the risk of emergence of variants. And we need to, and I hate to say this because everyone has the hope in vaccines, and I have exactly the same hope, that we will eventually get to vaccination coverage rates that will protect everybody. But we're not there yet. We are simply not there yet. And what is driving these huge spikes in infection, it may be contributed to by variants, but what is driving it is proximity between people. It is crowding and mixing of people without protection, without hand washing, in poorly ventilated spaces, without wearing masks. And I know how hard that is in the context of some countries, but that is the brutal reality. And some countries now are at such a rate of infection that their health systems are back under severe pressure. We've seen the tragedy in India. We need to avoid that same tragedy occurring in other countries, and some other countries are heading in that direction. And we need to take action. We need to take the heat out. This pandemic is global, but this pandemic is acting very differently in different countries. Each country is having a unique experience, and I would advise every country to look at their data now and see where you are. Look at where you are in this fight, and some of you are not in a good place. And you need to protect your health system. You need to get your oxygen supply sorted out. You need to sort out your clinical triage. You need to make arrangements for home care. Because some of you are not in a good position right now. And vaccines are not a solution right now. It's an awful thing to say, and it's a tragedy to say that in the context of what we see in vaccine equity and what Dr. Tedros is trying to do with Sumi and Mariangela Bruce and so many other partners to try and fix that. But we're not there yet. And we are going to have to stick to what we know works, shore up our health systems, drive down and suppress infection, and then accelerate the arrival of vaccines. I'm sorry to drive this home because I think it triggers a question in me because we keep coming back to why is this happening? Is it the variants? Is it this? Is it that? It's everything. It's everything. And the question is that happening? Yes. Is that a natural phenomenon? Yes. The real question is, what are we going to do about it? And some countries really need to take a look in the mirror in terms of what they're doing to drive infection rates down. Otherwise, our health systems in many countries will face real issues in the coming weeks and months.
Thank you very much for this. Next question goes to Ana Pinto, Folha de São Paulo. Ana, please unmute yourself.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question about the Chinese vaccines listed for emergency use. I guess Dr. Mariangela Simon told us on Monday that along with Sinopharm, the Sinovac vaccine was also expected to be listed to the end of this week. So I'd like to know if there is any news about the Sinovac vaccine. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anna, let me give this to Professor Arnaud Didier-Laurent, the chair of the TAG.
Yeah, thanks for the question. We have started review the report from Sinovac. We actually requested additional information to the manufacturer through a letter, so we're waiting for that answer. So again, it's you know, part of our role to actually assess the data, and then we had a reason to ask additional information that we hope to see to receive very soon to make a recommendation about this specific vaccine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next question goes to Christiane Ulrich from DPA. Christiane, please unmute yourself.
Thank you. I have a question on the Sputnik vaccine. How worried is WHO about the persistent concerns that there's a live version of virus, of the adenovirus vector in this vaccine? Is that one of the problems that you are looking at? And I just try my luck with a second one. Can WHO not buy patents of vaccine makers to make everyone happy? This is could be American suggestion to waive patents, but would that be an alternative option? Thank you.
Two very interesting questions. Let me start with Dr. Maria-Angela Simão, the Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products.
Thank you, Christiana, for the questions. On Sputnik is the vaccine that's produced by the Institut Gamaleya in Russia. It's still under assessment by WHO. We know of the concerns that were raised by one of the national regulatory authorities, but we are still with the process ongoing in WHO. We did have a team doing inspections in Russia now during April for the good clinical practices, together with the European Medicines Agency. And the 10th of May, we have a team again in Russia inspecting the good manufacturing practices for manufacturers. So at this current stage, we are still analyzing the data, receiving additional information on the dossier, and doing the inspections on site. That's what's happening now with Sputnik. We expect that the inspections will end the first week of June, and if we have the full dossier and all the information that's needed, we will be able to convene the TAG, the technical advisory group that for which Dr. Arnault is the chair. But it depends on the inspections being made and the dossier being completed. On the question on if WHO could buy patents, I don't think anyone can buy patents, right? Because it's a system that allows for either for the use of the TRIPS flexibilities in terms of compulsory license, voluntary license, and other things. Or like it's being discussed at the WTO at the moment for a waiver, which means a temporary suspension on intellectual property rights for COVID products. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Simão. Next question goes to Sophie Mokwena from SABC South Africa.
Thank you so much. I just want to check on the issue of building back better, the revival of the global economy. We know that the G7 countries will be meeting in June. Is there a specific message from the WHO that you would perhaps present to the G7, these industrialized nations, in terms of what needs to be done or to be taken into consideration as the world tries to rebuild the economy? Because without rebuilding of the economy, I can't see us even defeating this pandemic, because poverty can sometimes lead to situation where the behavior of people the behavioral change is very, very difficult because of poverty.
Thank you very much, Sophia. I look at Professor Mariana Mazzucato, the chair of the WHO Council on the Economics of Health All.
Right. So it's such an urgent question you're asking, Sophia, because, you know, this is not the first time that the globe has had a huge emergency to react to together. You remember that with the financial crisis, there was a lot of liquidity poured into the system basically in order to save capitalism, most of that finance went back into the financial sector. This time, what we have to make sure is that every country's recovery plan is not only strong, but is built in such a way that the funds actually land on the structures on the ground. And in the first instance, of course, on the health system, which has, you know, revealed to be very weak, but also on new forms of public-private partnerships. I think what this whole debate over the vaccine should hopefully reveal to us that it's not about, you know, the state or the private sector. It's actually about how to work together in better ways. And here I think we should really look at some countries where, for example, there's conditionalities attached to bailouts for particular sectors. I know that this goes beyond health, but I think we need to be learning kind of what works, what doesn't, also with other sectors. In France, for example, the recovery funds that went to the airlines and to the automotive were conditional on actually lowering their carbon emissions. And we know that there's very strong relationships, of course, with climate change and the health crisis. And we can't just keep going from one crisis to another. So embedding within our public-private partnerships a true Build Back Better design is fundamental. And for that, I think we need to look at how procurement works, you know, government as purchaser, how we look at grants, how we look at loans, but also how we literally look at the collaborations for innovation. And the Build Back Better, you know, slogan will just be a slogan unless we bring those ideas on the ground. And there's no better place to start than the vaccine. As Dr. Tedros said, if we don't do it with the vaccine, where are we going to do it? But also really fortifying a global welfare state, but also reimagining it, making it a modern 21st century welfare state. So also our health systems are innovative. Instead of having this dichotomy of innovation here and welfare state here, how can we really innovate through the health system itself and allow the industrial strategy, the innovation policy, to be at the center of how we think about health for all? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mazzucato. And
just to follow up on Professor's point, I think, and it's not a message to the G7 as a gathering of heads of state from some of the largest and most powerful countries in the world. The message from WHO and from partners is very much too focused. I think at this point, many of us may have expected we'd be coming out of this pandemic and we'd be thinking about the future. We're not. We're still in the heart of this thing. So therefore, the G7 has a twofold challenge, as does the G7, the EU, the African Union, everybody has. How do we stop this one, and how do we prevent the next one? It's very simple. There are political, there are innovation, there are operational, there are surveillance, and there are equity solutions to that. There are solutions needed across everything, from science and innovation to access to the systems we use to prevent and detect and respond to these events. And I would say, just following up to my previous comments, we do, and the G7 can show leadership in this. As I said, we've got to get our foot off the virus accelerators and get our foot on the solutions accelerators. And we have not had our foot on the accelerator for solutions, and we're suffering for not having done that. Bruce may follow up on that point.
Dr. Adler, please.
Thank you very much, Mike, and thanks, Sophie, for the question. I think from the perspective of the ACT Accelerator, we'd have a very clear message. We are now have countermeasures that can fundamentally change the shape of this pandemic over the coming months if they are equitably distributed. We cannot get there unless we close the financing gap for the ACT Accelerator, and the power of the G7 is essential for that. It's a $19 billion financing gap. As our guest speaker would have highlighted, that pales next to the costs that we're incurring every single day for this crisis and the inability to get countermeasures to people who need them. So we need the finance behind it. The second thing we need is a sharing of scarce resources. The G7 have contracted much of the crucial countermeasures, the vaccines we've been talking about, and we need to be able to share not just the doses, but the production capacity. Going back to one of the questions that were asked earlier today, the numbers are just getting more staggering. Nearly 1.25 billion people in this world, billion doses, of vaccines have been administered now, 1.25 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines around the world. About 5 million of those, and that's the number, have been in the lowest income countries. So the differences are staggering, and we need the help of the G7 to change that equation and raise the proportion of the populations that are vaccinated. Huge numbers of healthcare workers, huge numbers of older people have not seen a dose of vaccine. So for us, it's not an issue of who could you vaccinate so much as who you should vaccinate. And the G7, we've had some fantastic commitments to try and help on that, and hopefully that can be realized. And the last part, of course, is it's a problem because we simply don't have enough of the countermeasures. We need to scale up production of these countermeasures, the vaccines, the diagnostics, the oxygen, the PPE. We need the whole package, as Mike always emphasizes. And again, the industrial, financial, and other weight of the G7 in supporting that is going to be absolutely crucial. So we could be in a different position much faster globally than we will be unless we get that support to through the financing, the sharing, and also the scaling up of these products.
Thank you very much, all.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast, and that was a briefing from the World Health Organization Director General's Office in Geneva from yesterday, Friday, May 7th, 2021. Featuring Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus and his staff taking questions in regard to the status of the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic and also the vaccination programs that have been rolled out internationally, as well as the vaccine inequality that is, of course, being discussed widely within the WHO and other circles internationally. And that's going to conclude the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for today, Saturday, May 8th, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to the website, panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out with the music of the Clifford Brown Max Roach Quintet. This is from an album entitled The California Concerts from 1954. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off. Have a beautiful week.
Presenting the outstanding exponents of the new jazz, led by Max Roach at the drums.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to introduce you to, at this time, George Bledsoe, our bass violinist. Our pianist, Carl Perkins. Teddy Edwards, our tenor saxophonist. And the great Clifford Brown on trumpet.
First, all God's children got rhythm. Thank you. Now it's our pleasure to present Clifford Brown playing for you Tenderly. Thank you. a Teddy Edwards original, Sunset Eyes.